Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Michael Parenti. Michael is an internationally known, highly respected political scientist and award-winning author and lecturer. He's written so many books. He's got a new one out. We want to talk about it on the program and other things that Michael may have on his mind. His new book is titled, it's a little different from some of his others, but it's got to be a marvelous read. He titles it, Waiting for Yesterday, Pages from a Street Kid's Life. Well, I remember this street kid's life many years ago, and Michael and I are of the same generation. Michael, before we could begin, can I just make one comment? This morning, I just finished writing an article I'll get out tomorrow on Herman Wallace. He was one of the Angola Three wrongfully imprisoned inmates down at the hellish prison in Louisiana state prison system, a hellish prison that in the olden days was a slave plantation, and it still is today in modern form. And it's very sad, the email I just got moments before airtime, and I'll just quote from it. This morning we lost, without a doubt, the biggest, bravest, and brashest personality in the political prisoner world. It is with great sadness that we write with the news of Herman Wallace's passing. Herman never did anything halfway. He embraced his many quests and adventures in life with a tenacious gusto and fearless determination that will absolutely never be rivaled, and it goes on. Well, I will revise my article accordingly because one of the lines in it I said, his life hangs by a thread. On October 1st, he was released after spending over four decades in solitary confinement, if you can just imagine anything like that, in almost total isolation, 23 hours a day, an hour a day at most, to take a shower, to walk around a very closed compound. This is what he went through this for over 40 years. He contracted liver cancer. He was given short time to live. On October 1st, he was transferred to a New Orleans hospital. He was there, and I had no idea. Before I quoted from something earlier material that said basically it was estimated he would live until the end of October. Well, he didn't quite make it, so he passed, and I certainly want to pay tribute to him. Albert Wilcox is another one of the he was wrongfully imprisoned. He killing a prisoner guard. He had nothing to do with it, and another inmate was bribed for special treatment to lie and say that Herman committed the crime along with Albert Woodfox and King. Maybe I got the first names mixed up. One of them is Albert King and Woodfox. They were both wrongfully accused as well, the Angola Three. King was released in 2001. Woodfox is still held in isolation. An innocent man had nothing to do with it. This is the way prison judicial system in America works. Political prisoners infest America's gulag, and I've written plenty about that. Michael, I welcome you to this. I'm sure you know about the Angola Three situation, and until, again, moments ago, I had no idea that Herman Wallace died, but I knew he didn't have long to live.
Yes, it's a terrible thing. The shoe, we have shoe here in California, too, and called special housing unit, and they're the same things of men and, in some cases, women living in total isolation. What some people have come to understand is that solitary confinement is not just solitary. It really is a form of torture. And it's a form of torture that goes on and on. Excuse me, as I lose my voice here.
It's early in the morning for you.
Yeah, it's 8 o'clock in the morning. It's very unusually early for me. Anyway, there's that. That's the problem. And it really should be abolished. The solitary confinement should. There have been people who, you know, they get there and they get very limited reading resources to read. I think they get a ratty old black and white television set, and that's about it. And that's their human contact or non-human contact. And the it's not 23 hours a day. It really is 24. That hour They just come out of their cell and they're in another enclosed area. They never see natural light. They never see the sky. Or many of them develop eye problems because their vision never goes more than about 6 feet in distance. It's just absolutely terrible. It's quite terrible. And people are being corralled into prison as mercilessly as ever. I just was reading of a case of a guy who arrested half a gram on him, a possession, marijuana, half a gram, and 20 years he got in prison. A lot of the private prisons are open, and when jail cells are not filled, the state has to pay the private contractor the equivalent anyway. So it's a rip-off of the taxpayers paying for something terrible that they don't really want and need. We all know the case of, what was her name, Marissa Alexander, I think.
Michelle Alexander.
Michelle Alexander, who fired the... No. That's Michelle Alexander, the commentator. No, it's a woman who...
Oh, the woman who wrote the new Jim Crow?
No. The woman who fired the shot in the wall to scare off her abusive boyfriend.
Oh, that I don't know.
And
that
she got 20 years in prison for firing this gun. 20 years. She's in prison right now. The case is being appealed, but it's outrageous, utterly outrageous. And both those examples I gave, the one with the possession and this one, were African-American, too. And studies show that African-Americans, first-time offenders, where the offense is less than what some whites have committed, still get longer and heavier penalties than whites. I mean, there's a terrible racism still going on in terms of the treatment people get in the criminal justice system.
Michael, that absolutely is true. I've written a fair amount of articles on the U.S. prison system, and I rightfully call it a gulag, even just the domestic part of it. But, of course, it's a global gulag. I've written about dozens of U.S. torture prisons in countries around the world, countries, U.S. allied countries in Western Europe and other in the Middle East, elsewhere. It's a shocking system. And this torture, not only that goes on abroad, this torture in U.S. prisons, and it certainly goes on in Angola, in Louisiana, that has been rightfully called America's worst prison. And, again, it went from an old-time slave plantation to a modern day one where the brutalization of prisoners is absolutely horrific, and Woodfox and King and Wallace were persecuted because they organized the first Black Panther chapter, either the first or one of the first Black Panther chapters in a U.S. prison, and it worked to improve prison conditions. That was their crime. That's why they were targeted and wrongfully accused of killing a prison guard that they had nothing to do with, and they ended up spending decades in solitary confinement. King got out in 2001. Woodfox is still there, and Wallace just died.
Yeah, it's terrible to hear that about him dying. Well, I don't know what to say.
It's the way things are, Michael. I mean, you know as well as I do. You write about it all the time.
Yeah, the system does. A lot of people are put into the solitary torture system who have done nothing but, say, have a notebook with a Mexican symbolic symbol on it or some slightest thing that they might, on a suspicion that they might be organizing some prison group of their own, A lot of it can be fabricated. A lot of it is snitch. If the guards don't like a certain person and they think he's political or he shows leadership capacity or something of that, they'll pin something on him and he goes into solitary confinement, and he can appeal that every 6 years. When his if his appeal is turned down, this is the California system for you. If the appeal is turned down, he gets a chance to appeal again in 6 years of solitary confinement and more. And so these people serve decades in solitary. It's really mad, it's crazy, it is.
It shows the barbarism of this country, Michael, and too few people know about it. You know the individuals, their family members, they know what's going on, but such a small percentage of people, well, there are so many people in prison that it's not a small number who know about this, but most other people who have no connection to the prison system, they have no idea the abuses that go on inside. It's not discussed in the U.S. mainstream media. If it ever is, it gets sloughed over very easily, and when it is, it's very rare that anything much is said, and again, it's just horrific stuff.
Yeah. Yes, Stephen.
Oh, let's segue, Michael, because we certainly don't have a lengthy period for you and I to have a marvelous discussion, but I do want to get into your new book. You have a brand new book, and I remember the last time you came on, you said that you were working on it, and it would be out, I forget exactly when you mentioned it, it would be, but I guess it is available now, and again, mm-hmm. You call it Waiting for Yesterday. I love that title. Pages from a subtitle, Pages from a Street Kid's Life. Oh, tell listeners about the new book.
Well, it's a sort of an ethnic memoir. It's of about my life in Italian Harlem. It was Harlem. A lot of people don't know this, but there was an East Harlem, and that was occupied by about 90,000 Italian Americans. Composed the largest Italian community outside of Italy. I mean, largest one in the United States at the time. And it was working class, blue collar, very poor. As I say in the book, people often say the slums are a problem, and then others say, no, the slums are not a problem, they're the solution. That's where you throw marginal and low-performing groups and crowd them in there, and poor housing and such. But I argued that no, it's not. The slums aren't just the solution in that way, but they're the place where are housed a whole proletarian of poorly paid, hard-working people who go out and then, you know, carry out work as mechanics and machinists and bus drivers and ditch diggers and grave diggers and working in candy stores and beauty parlors and pizza parlors and ice cream parlors and every kind of occupation that you can think of. And you realize that what the slum really is a population that does the work of civilization and goes forth every day to keep society running. And I talk about the family and the street, the gangs, the church, the school, and various things. And it was a lot of fun, the book was. I must say that I really enjoyed writing it, and people have been enjoying reading it. And the remarks of a lot of readers are very revealing. That is, they seem to find something. Both the, when you read a memoir, you know, you're looking for the differences from your own life. And at the same time, you also find similarities to your own life. And when you have people who live in Kansas and say, this reminds me, or once lived in Kansas, this reminds me of my family on the plains of Kansas. How could it remind you? I mean, it's a totally different place, but that's where you get a feeling about the human comedy, you know, that people's foibles and ways are sort of the same no matter where you are.
Michael, refresh my memory. I've read nearly all your books, and they're on my shelf. A good portion of a shelf in one of my bookcases has your books on it. Very proudly, I have them. I consider it a very important collection. You really gave me an education, your books alone. And in one of your books, I believe, you talked about your upbringing, and I can't remember which one it was.
Well, one of the essays, which is reinserted in this book, too, the same one, I think, was in Dirty Truths, is where I had it toward the end. I had an essay on my family. I expanded that essay, and that's now in this book, too. That was about my immigrant grandparents, how they thought, how they survived, how the family got on, and that sort of thing. There's been a terrific explosion in memoirs now, and the New York Times bestseller list not long ago, I looked in, it was the paperback nonfiction. Of the 20 titles that were in there, about 14 of them were memoirs or personal accounts of some kind. And sometimes they're kind of trivial, you know. And if you take ordinary experiences, you got to say something. You got to show the extraordinary contention of it, or the commonality is portrayed in a way that people want to read it, you know, because they get some kind of recognition about their own experience. So those are the two things about a memoir that you should shoot for, both as a writer or as a reader, too. Namely, you see the commonality, how it links to things in your own life, and it gives you an understanding, and you say, oh, yeah, an affirmation and a reinforcement, or how it's something different from your own life, and that, too, becomes interesting and how it's spread. And what I do through the book is also constantly reference other ethnic groups, too. I mention black African-Americans, the Irish-Americans that came before the Italians in some of these same areas, the Puerto Ricans, Jews, and different groups. And it was just very enjoyable to write the thing, and people seem to enjoy it a lot. There's a lot of occasion to write humorous kind of things, funny things.
I have a feeling that your upbringing and mine were very, very similar, because I grew up in inner city Boston, a mixed neighborhood. And some of my best memories go back to those years.
Where was that, in North End, or where were you?
It was in Roxbury.
Oh, Roxbury. Sure. Wow.
And some of my best memories go back to those days in the 1940s. I was born in the mid 1930s, mm-hmm. and my memories go back to the late 1930s and 40s. And mm-hmm. I remember World War II, as you do, Michael, and the aftermath. I remained in Boston. We stayed in Roxbury until the early
1950s. Oh, yeah, I wanted to say school was one of the other things that I talked about, what school was like. And it was, just to take in our prison stuff, the major concern in school was control, as I remember. You know, sit quietly with your hands folded and eyes glued to the head in front of you. That was the phrase, eyes glued to the head in front of you. And we were taught patriotism, and we had to sing all those songs. Did you have to do that when you were?
We used to pledge allegiance to the flag.
Right, pledge allegiance.
And during World War II, we bought war stamps.
Right, you buy war stamps, scrap iron, scrap paper campaigns. You gathered scrap iron, scrap paper, and then you sang the songs. Remember Pearl Harbor and Anchors Away, and the caissons go rolling along.
All that sort of stuff. And when the war ended, we had drills in case there was a nuclear attack by the Ruskies.
Oh, that was after my time. Yeah. Well, how old are you, Stephen? You're only probably about 74 or 5.
79.
Oh, wow.
I'm talking about post 1945.
All right. Yeah, I'm 80. I just turned 80 2 days ago.
Oh, my goodness! Happy birthday.
Oh, it's not so happy. 80 is a big number. You know?
Oh, well, I'll reach that number next year. Yeah, that really is a big number.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and so you see similarities, you do, you know. I think you would if you read the book. I think it would hit home.
Oh, it would hit home. It absolutely would home, and it would take me back to things that I remember myself. And again, having grown up in the same era, we literally lived through the same things, and we both were products of big inner cities, Boston and New York,
right.
not really far away.
Right, and if you really have the sense for it, the feel for it, you can turn it into pretty entertaining and amusing anecdotes and such, you know. My book is only 150 pages, but I have 47 chapters, so go figure. Some of the chapters are pretty short. And along with box inserts and all sorts of other things. And it was great fun to write, and people are really liking it. And I write about not just personal experience, but also I have two chapters in there about Italy in World War I and World War II. Well, why? Because the book is really about Italian Americans, not about Italy. I just felt like it. I just thought there were things about both those experiences which should have been clarified a long time ago. And it was some interesting history. And oddly enough, people didn't say, why do you have those two in there? They said, wow, that was interesting. I didn't know that, you know, stuff like that.
I remember something about Lucky Luciano being released from prison to help during World War II with the war cause to, get the mafioso in Sicily to get on support the cause of the Allies against the Nazis.
Well, to build waterfront security. He had his guys going around because there was a lot of sabotage going on the waterfront, where you know these ships were being hauled off and all that, and a lot of espionage too, for that matter. But I write about Lucky Luciano and compare him to Mother Cabrini. I have a digression where Mother Cabrini was America's first saint. And she, who was an Italian until the age of 57, and I think about the last 8 years of her life, she was a naturalized American citizen. But they claimed her as the first American citizen, whereas Lucky Luciano, who came to this country when he was 7 years old and learned all his dirty work and mobster ways and learned all that on the streets of America in New York, he was called an Italian mobster, you know, to the last days of his life, even though he lived his entire life in the U.S. So I thought it was a very selective kind of claim, you know. Luciano, who was an American citizen, was called an Italian mobster to the day he died. And Mother Cabrini, who was an Italian, was called our first American saint. So we see how selective the media are in terms of having people perceive various groups. And of course, I talk about a lot of that and how people are just misperceived. All sorts of groups are. But
you certainly know about media distortion, Michael. I believe you wrote the first book ever discussing the way the media operates in America, and I read it, and it's been a while, I forget the precise title, but before Manufacturing Consent by Chomsky and Edward Herman, you wrote a book preceding their book.
It was called Inventing Reality. When it came out, it was highly reviewed and all that, and I met Ed Herman, and he said, oh, Noam Chomsky and I are going to write a book. Oh, don't worry, we'll cite you, Michael. But they never got around to citing me, although they used a lot of the stuff. And they named their book Manufacturing Consent. They hurried, really hurried with it to get it out. I'll never forget that.
Well, I've read them both, and it certainly is an education. Anybody can read them and get an education if they don't already have one. I think today most people, or at least a good many people, understand that the major media in America absolutely don't tell people what they need to know. They do exactly the opposite. But you were the first one, Michael, who wrote it up in an important book, and it really, to this day, it's a book absolutely worth reading.
Right. There were some path breakers before. I mean, you know, Upton Sinclair wrote a book called The Brass Check.
It was
probably not written quite as carefully as mine, if I must say so myself. Excuse me, there's something going on. Oh my God, can you hear the noise?
No, I can't.
Oh, you can't. All right, then we won't worry.
Trouble
about
in the streets?
No, it's these crazy damned leaf blowers and things of that sort.
When
we live here in blissful residential areas, you realize that the residential area in America often is an industrial center with chainsaws and leaf blowers and cars revving up and all of that stuff. So, and then friends come over and say, "Gee, it's very quiet here." I said, "No, you just hit a quiet moment." But no, this is America. Noise pollution is, it's down the list in terms of the problems we have. We have other much more serious problems, but...
Indeed, Michael, this program spends an awful lot of time talking about them. We are nearly at the end of the program, and I want to let you get in your last thoughts, either on the book or whatever else is on your mind.
I just would invite the reader to pick up a copy. It's a fun read, and people really enjoy it. And I've gotten feedback on it. It was so nice. And it's nice to be able to write something that will bring enjoyment and enlightenment at the same time. It's not just there to amuse or distract, but also... It brings in history and brings in politics and it brings in the whole human comedy. So that was the book. And the other thing I would recommend to your listeners is to keep listening to you, Stephen, because you do have a lot to give to people, so, and it's much appreciated, I'm sure.
Michael, I really appreciate that, and I want to stress again, your books have meant so much to me over the years, and again, they're on my shelf, The Face of Imperialism, God and His Demons, Democracy for the Few. Democracy for the Few, I reviewed, Michael, in great detail. And
book I'm no longer earning money on it. The publisher has gone to Chapter 11.
Oh, my goodness.
Very conniving way. And so now it looks like I'm one of the creditors, and I haven't gotten paid in the last over a year, last two royalty periods. Don't mean to get these personal things in, but just let people know how writers are really under siege by the profiteers who are taking things over.
You really are, Michael, and that book was extraordinary. 9 editions of the book?
Yeah, 9 editions. People should go, if they're interested in the things you're referencing, they might want to go to my website, which is michaelparenti.org.
Oh, indeed. Everything is there, including other information about your articles and your work and yourself.
mp@michaelparenti.org. No, mp, that's my email. No, okay. It's www.michaelparenti.org, and you can see all the various titles, and there are a lot of articles to read, and there are tapes to listen to if you want.
Michael, I go back and glance through the pages of some of the books of yours I read years ago, and if the material is just as fresh now as when you wrote it. That's
unfortunately,
why your
book
is so
that's
important.
True. Yeah, unfortunately, it's true. You think the world would have improved somewhat or something.
About the only thing that changes is things keep getting worse, Michael, as we know.
Yeah.
It keeps me busy.
That's another talk sometime. Right.
Michael, I thank you so much. The music means I have to sign off. I so much to having you back.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Michael. Join us this weekend at noon Central Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.